Welcome to EIR Talks. On February 16, 2002, the president and founder of the International Schiller Institute, Helga Zepp-LaRouche, addressed its President's Day conference in Reston, Virginia. This week we bring you part two of her presentation, The Dialogue of Cultures. Over 1,000 attendees were present, and we also bring you part of an open dialogue which transpired from the audience.
You have the gold mask of Tutanchamun from about 1325 BC. And again, this is an unbelievably beautiful face where I cannot say if it's African or European or Asian or maybe a mixture of all of these. In any case, it can again only come from the beauty of the image of the artist. When this picture was shown for the first time in 1817 in the British Museum, it caused a world sensation because of its beauty, because it obviously violated all the prejudices that all the Egyptians were ugly and so forth. Then, after Alexander the Great conquered Egypt and created the Library of Alexandria, the center of Egyptian Greek studies for a long time, this presented a next step of progress. The next major step forward was classical Greece, especially Plato, and the development of the Platonic method. Christianity obviously laid the basis, the decisive foundation for European civilization, and represented a watershed in that it broke with the cyclical idea of nature and prepared the ground for the limitless perfection of man in the image of God. But politically, the idea that every man is in the image of God was not yet realized, because the Roman Empire was an empire based on the oligarchical power elite and a mass of slaves. When the Roman Empire collapsed, as all empires eventually do, the torch of progress was carried further in India in the Gupta period, and also in China, next slide, where in the same period when in India the Gupta period produced some of the most beautiful dramas and poetry, you have in China these kinds of Buddhas, which again, if you look at the incredibly fine facial expression, had to represent a conception of man which was very lofty and noble. Next, very fascinating is also the Tang Dynasty in the 7th century, where this Chinese lady obviously was a model at the time, and obviously has a very interesting personality. Next, here, this is also from the Tang Dynasty, the 7th century AD girls playing polo. Now, I find this completely intriguing. This is one picture of a whole group of girls playing polo. For sure, in Europe, people didn't play polo at the time because it was a dark age. it just gives you a glimpse, you know, where, I mean, a taste to, I hope, instilling a desire to look more into these cultures and explain how this was possible. Now, while in Europe there was still a dark age, the Arab Renaissance occurred of the Abbasid dynasty in the 8th century. And in 766 AD, Baghdad, the same Baghdad which they want to bomb now again, was the world center of culture. 100,000 architects, craftsmen, and construction workers completed Baghdad. And it was only through the contact of the Caliph Harun al-Rashid with Charles the Great that Europe could reconnect with its own cultural roots, because the caliphs had sent emissaries to all Mediterranean countries asking them to collect all knowledge, including the Egyptian, the Spanish, the Italian, and the Greek knowledge. So Europe needed the infusion from the Arabs to find its own sources. The same fruitful contact again occurred between Frederick II, the Hohenstaufer, and the Arabs. Ramon Lullus in the 13th century forcefully made the argument of the need for the dialogue of cultures. Another excellent example of the exchange of cultures is the missionary work of the Jesuit Matteo Ricci in China, born in 1573, who gained the trust of the Chinese emperor and the mandarins by bringing European culture and science, and on the other side demonstrated that for him the difference between the religious rites and was less important than the one knowable truth. Before that, you had obviously the beautiful Renaissance in Italy, in Moorish and Andalusian Spain, but also in Poland and Germany. And this was only possible through the revival of the classical Greek and the Egyptian ideas. In the same way, later the German classical period revived the classical and Renaissance concepts. If you look at these long streams of contributions over generations and generations, the American Revolution again represented a watershed of history by establishing for the first time a truly sovereign nation state and a constitution where the practice, where in practice the guaranteed inalienable rights of all people was indeed written and guaranteed as a in the true republican representative system. Now, were the founding fathers an autochthonous species, an autarkical phenomena? No, they were not. But they were a reflection of the best traditions of European culture, the Renaissance idea of the sovereign nation state being obliged to the common good of the people as being the only thing which gives legitimacy to the power of the government. The American Revolution was not autochthonous, but it reflected the best traditions of Europe, including that of Leibniz. So the American Revolution, and as it was revived by Lincoln and Martin Luther King, clearly represents the high point of American culture. We must have a dialogue of cultures where we focus on the best periods of each one, in which this culture moved mankind forward. Therefore, we have to revive our own best traditions and then see how all the cultures influenced each other through ideas over very long stretches of time and how they enriched the following cultures and civilizations. And then you see that the approach of universal history of the one human race, of the one mankind, is the only approach that makes sense. The danger of a clash of civilization is the result of oligarchism, whose ability to control depends on playing up the differences, play conflicts, play on petty-mindedness. If this dialogue of cultures, which is seen by many, many people in the world as the only way to go, by the Pope, by many people in the United Nations, by President Mubarak, by President Khatami, and many others, and if you add to what they say with the specific approach I suggest, namely that you have to approach it from the standpoint of universal history, then I'm absolutely certain this will lead to a new beautiful Renaissance and the end of oligarchism. I want to encourage a dialogue among the children and youth of the world in this spirit. This is a proposal I already discussed when we were in India in December and in Russia, where basically I proposed to influential people that they should sponsor such a dialogue. The idea is basically to engage children and young people from all over the world who should not only study the best traditions of their own cultures, but also those pearls of the other cultures. And then they will learn to love the other culture as their own. This idea, which already convinced some of the people working with children and youth, for example, this was discussed at a youth conference in India beginning of the year, where 400 children from all over India participated, and they want to be part of this ongoing dialogue. The idea that these children and youth from different countries should engage in such projects and then soon form the first international children and youth parliament, so that the children have a say in what the future should look like. I'm absolutely sure that children do not want to grow up in a 100-year war to come, or not grow up for that matter, because this war would destroy their future. Now let's go back to CUSA one more time. In the beautiful dialogue on mind, the philosopher says, "You have explained wonderfully well the statement of Hermes Trismegistus, who said that God is named by the names of all things, and all things are named by God's name." To which the layman answers, "By means of a very lofty intellectual grasp, enfold into a coinciding both naming and being named, and all will be clear. For God is the preciseness of whatsoever thing." Nicolaus is calling us here to the realization that in God opposites coincide, for God is undifferentiated being in itself. And in Dr. Ignorantia, Nicolaus says, "Hence, Hermes Trismegistus rightly says, since God is the totality of all things, no name is proper to him, for either he would have to be called by every name, or else all things would have to be called by his name. For in him simplicity he enfolds, for in his simplicity he enfolds the totality of all things." It is most remarkable that he mentions Hermes Trismegistus both in respect to what is called negative theology, that you cannot do justice to the nature of God by describing him in terms of concrete predicates, as well as in respect to the method of coincidence thinking. And this is the one, in my view, probably most important aspect of the Cusanus philosophy. He himself repeatedly stressed that he was teaching something which had never been taught before. Other thinkers conceived of the idea of unity which precedes all contradictory statements. But what makes Nicolaus' coincidence thinking different is to show how contradicting substantial causes coexist in a principled connectedness before they separate into their differentiation. In the universe, there exists a hierarchical order of higher and lower species, which develop into each other from multiple individual differentiation. But the development does not occur from the bottom up, so to speak, but from above. In the writing on mind, Nicolaus develops the idea that God's knowledge only descends downward into the nature of the human mind, further down in the scale of things, but it only descends through the human mind. And it is the higher which elevates the lower one. Nicolaus even says that it is being snatched up, that man partakes in God in this way, the animal participates in the human in this way, by being snatched up. And this is why the physical universe obeys the human mind. This method of thinking from above, from the level of the coincidence of opposites, is a universal methodological concept applicable to all aspects of life. This is why seemingly unsolvable conflicts can be solved on a higher level, why the dialogue of cultures can succeed if we start from the one mankind. In De Berillo, when Nicolaus discusses this method, he says also, and fourth, turn to what Hermes Trismegistus says, that man is a second God. Because as God is the creator of that what really exists and the forms given by nature, so man is the creator of what exists conceptually and in the forms made by the mind. But Nicolaus says the human mind is also capable to create through comprehension. There is existence which is not because God created it, and which the human mind therefore could only assimilate or repeat, but which is created by the human mind entirely. In this sense, the pure power of creation is divine. man can be understood as a second god. Nicolaus argues that it is this creative intellect which is the self-similar image of the divine spirit, which the mere imitation, the repetition, is not, which is non-similarity. The more truly creative man is in this way, the more he becomes similar to God. What a beautiful way to set man free, to realize his fullest potential, and to locate man's identity on the highest, most loftiest plane. And is it not beautiful that Kusa sees in the Hermetic thinking that central truth which is also transmitted in Christianity? So Samuel Huntington and Mary Lefkowitz, for that matter, can go and play Rumpelstiltskin. Nicolaus is completely right that there is a concordantia philosophorum and theologorum, a concordance of philosophy and theology. The difference lies only in the different expressions, not in the substance of the truth itself. And is it not beautiful that with the testimony of the dead white European males, we can prove the Egyptian contribution to European culture? Universal history is a lot of fun.
Tony Chaitkin from Leesburg. You spoke about the Freemasons, and I wanted you, if you could, to say something about the difference between what you've brought to us today and the use of the so-called Hermetic tradition by imperial racists, culminating in people like Albert Pike, and really all throughout history, who are dragging up elements of real history and turning it into something that they say is passed along by oligarchs and the nobility, and is their treasure and their property. Unfortunately, also. This mystified way of looking at what you have presented is given as a weapon into the hands of people who would otherwise rebel against this. We have Ford Foundation sponsored black radicalism in the 60s that would mystify this tradition, along the same lines as Pike and so forth. Earlier Masons in Europe, certainly, of the type of Mozart, or even what Leibniz was doing, looking at different things like the Rosicrucians, bring up the question of the intention of looking at this history and the intention of the conveying the meaning of this. So if you could just comment on the use of this history or the way of looking at it, differentiating what you have just done, which is essential to humanity, versus this imperial racist tradition.
Well, I think the argument I tried to make is that the Clash of Civilization crowd and the extreme right wing, you know, where Mary Lefkowitz, for example, belongs to, or Samuel Huntington, in reality do the same thing what the radical black people do, namely to reduce the history to one particular view. While I think that if one really studies universal history from the standpoint of the necessary predecessor ideas, that one has to come to the conclusion that there is only one human race, that there are not five human races, or and that even, you know, the influences of the different high points of culture, which was always associated with a specific image of men, is always the same one. In other words, that if you have an image of man which is very noble and close to the idea of man in the image of God, you have classical periods. And if you have an idea of an oligarchical elite where man is better cattle or equal to cattle, then you have collapses of civilization. So I think that the history of such periods in which mankind was moved forward can be completed. And I actually would like to encourage people, you know, because obviously universal history is a very big subject and one cannot do justice to it with one speech. But I think it is a method of approaching things by looking for that which indeed, you know, contributed to the progress of history. Now, other uses of this, I mean, Freemasonry was definitely a mixed thing in the beginning, and there are still mixed tendencies today. I mean, I have met Freemasons in Europe who were quite good people. But in general, one can say that the idea of initiation rites, of a secret knowledge shared by ever higher circles of people, you know, is really a totally wrong conception, because the, you know, knowledge should be transparent and it should be accessible to the whole population. So I think that, you know, one cannot possibly go, I mean, there were so many cults, so many sects. If you read Augustine, you know, the Roman Empire was full of the most unbelievable such sects. And I think that as today, many of these things are really controlled for the divide and conquer game, which is why I think it is extremely essential to trace the universal history from the standpoint of Schiller and how he approached it. That you have to account that if you can also use Lynn's worldwide cup of coffee, but that you have to account for the present moment in history by tracing it back to all the necessary predecessors of these ideas. And then you indeed find such a lineage which is quite obvious.
Hello, Helg. I'm Joe Jennings from Houston. I would like to touch upon the initial ministry of Jesus Christ was actually addressing a certain inadequacy that had developed in Judaism, which had become, at least at that point, a kind of enforcer for Roman legalist doctrine that was ruling the world at that point. But then some 700 years later, we find that that under the name of Christianity, you had a similar legalist doctrine entrenched in Constantinople and the Eastern Church there that explicitly rejected the filioque. And so from the standpoint of universal ideas, I mean, can we say that Islam, which asserted itself, which in a certain rejection of what was ruling the world out of Constantinople at that point, was that a necessary progression or an advance? Because I don't know if filioque as such exists as a concept within Islam, but can we nonetheless say that in the succession of universal ideas that this was, you know, a step forward toward the advancement of civilization and Renaissance ideas for all mankind? Because I mean, I'm talking to a lot of Islamic people in Houston these days, and you know, I encounter a certain fundamentalism of a certain sort there that I also talk to with Christians, and I don't know if you have that kind of filioque concept that exists within Islam, and maybe you could touch upon that.
Well, as far as I know, Islam rejects the idea of the Trinity, and you know, I find it always very useful to look at Ramon Lulus and Nicolaus of Cusa discussing the Trinity, because they have this philosophical conception where the Trinity is not only the Father, the Son, and the Spirit, but that this really talks about the process of creation, that you have got the creator, the created object, and the process of creation, which both Ramon Lulus and Cusa call also an expression of the Trinity, which they attribute to this earlier Hermetic tradition. So, you know, both in Doctor Ignorantia, in On Mind, Cusa claims that he philosophically can prove the philosophical existence of the Trinity. And I think if you read Doctor Ignorantia, it is actually a very plausible a way of looking at things, and it helps people to be weaned from fundamentalism. You see, the point I'm trying to make is not that all religions are the same. I'm not saying that. And I'm not encouraging people to leave their religion and go to some new religion. But I'm saying that, you know, that if we are looking at the danger of a clash of civilization and a religious war, my efforts were trying to build a bridge of how you can relate on a philosophical basis to something which is uniting all of these religions, and that there are actually in all different religions and cultures people who were extremely concerned about that. Plato, Augustine, Cusa, and many others. And I think that, you know, look, we are in a wasteland. Who knows anything about culture these days? You go to Germany and you talk to pupils or young people of 20 years and you ask them, what's the difference between Leibniz, Lessing, and Heine, and Mörike? And, you know, you can be happy if they have heard these names, but they for sure don't know any poem or writing by them. And, you know, my whole point is that what we have to do, if we want to have a dialogue of cultures, you have to obviously have something from which to dialogue from. If you know nothing about your own culture, you have nothing to say. You know, so I want to encourage people that rather than looking blindly at, you know, whatever they believe in a self-evident way, that they become reflexive and say, which were actually the best periods of Islam? It's obviously not Taliban. It's obviously the Abbasid dynasty. It's obviously Avicenna, Al-Kindi, Al-Farabi, you know, great minds, you know, Avicenna, Ibn Sina, who developed medicine in the 11th century in Persia, which was the official medicine in Europe until the 17th century. So for 700 years, he was the most developed in terms of the medical science. And I want to people look at their own history to look for those periods which were the best. And this is the key to crack oligarchism.
You're listening to EIR Talks. We'll return in a moment with more of our presentation of Part 2 of Helga LaRouche on the Dialogue of Cultures, presented at the 2002 President's Day Conference of the Schiller Institute. Welcome back to EIR Talks. We'll continue now with more of Helga LaRouche at the President's Day Conference of the Schiller Institute, February 16, 2002.
About 25 years ago, I was engaged in an effort to create an Avicenna Foundation, which was the idea, you know, that the Arab world and the Islamic world should go back to their best traditions, to the Abbasid Caliphates, to Ibn Sina, and, you know, take that as the reference point. Now, this foundation never came into being, mainly because people didn't like what I had written in the founding document, that that the goal of this foundation would be that every Arab and every Islamic person should become a genius. And they freaked out and said, you have to take this out, because this is not something we want. And later I was told by one of the scholars who was participating in the effort that the Saudis didn't like this idea. Now, obviously, if you have only Arab and Islamic geniuses, the question is, do you still need a royal family, you know? So, I mean, what I'm actually discussing has really a very far-reaching, explosive power to it, that if, you know, if each culture, if the children start to look at their own best traditions and, you know, become conscious about that and then go to the other culture and say, oh, these are the most beautiful dramas in Sanskrit writing, these are the most beautiful paintings in Italian culture, these are the most beautiful sculptures in China, and so forth and so on. And they start to love this, because you can only love what you know. You know, if you're an ignoramus, a know-nothing, you know, and you're self-evident as a fat particle sitting on your blood and soil, you know, then you have the problem, you know. And my whole idea is that, I mean, look, we have reached such a crucial point in human history where in former times you could have cultures bloom and elsewhere in the world they collapsed. You know, like when the Roman Empire collapsed, you had the Gupta period in India, you had the beautiful Chinese Buddhism in China, but they did not know about each other because it took decades to travel. But now, for the very first time, we are sitting in one boat. Mankind, for the very first time, is sitting in one boat because AIDS is a universal global problem. Nuclear weapons, other weapons are easily global problems. Communication, the world indeed has become a village. We are connected through, you know, all kinds of modern communication systems. And I absolutely have been thinking about this for a long time. If we go into a dark age, we go as a whole population, as a world population. It will not be that Africa dies and the United States will prosper. Forget it. It will not happen. Not because Africa has nuclear weapons, but because if we morally cannot save the African continent, that says something about our inability to save ourselves from a moral standpoint. So we, for the first time, have reached a point in history where we better call forth the best traditions of all of civilization up to the present time. And if we do that, you know, I think, you know, renaissances always were made by referring to the best traditions of the past. And I'm actually optimistic that, you know, if we could get young people from the different cultures to say, no, we don't want a war of civilization. We don't want religious war. We want to have peace among the religions and the cultures. I'm absolutely certain that this idea could take off in a way, you know, where oligarchism soon will be something forgotten or something in the museums. You will have little statues of Kissinger and and Samuel Huntington and Brzezinski, and then children will come, you know, and look at that as artifacts of old phenomena which does no longer exist. I absolutely think this is feasible.
Good afternoon. My name is Carlos Ward. We come from Guatemala, where we have recently founded the LaRouche movement.
Nosotros somos un país que tenemos 23 etnias. De ellas, 22 son de origen maya.
We are a country with 23 different ethnic groups. 22 of them are from of Mayan origin.
Sin embargo, desde hace algunos años que se ha dado un gran impulso al movimiento maya, no se trata realmente de buscar que haya un diálogo entre esas diferentes etnias, sino nos están empujando prácticamente a una confrontación étnica en el país.
Some years now, we have had a tremendous push for this Mayan culture. However, what they're doing is not to promote a dialogue among the different ethnic groups, but moving us towards a confrontation in the country.
Lo que quisiera saber en concreto es qué tenemos que hacer para iniciar el movimiento también del Instituto Schiller en Guatemala y en Centroamérica.
What I would like to ask you concretely is, what do we need to do so we can carry this Schiller Institute movement into Guatemala and the rest of the area?
Well, I would have to discuss with you concretely, you know, what are the possibilities. But I think, you know, the key thing is that you find some people who are willing to represent this approach. And then you just start to do it. Find somebody who represents, in Judaism, Philo of Alexandria, Moses Maimonides, Mendelssohn, because these were people who were very religious, very, very Jewish, but they were not chauvinist. In the same way, find people who represent in Christianity the willingness to have this kind of ecumenical dialogue. And, you know, I think that the, you know, some of the indigenous groups, you know, I mean, they just have to also recognize the fact that some of these cultures did not necessarily contribute to civilization. But one has to be very, very generous, you know. I think that one has to find that which you know makes them human, and we are all human. So I think that one way of doing it would be to organize it, for example, in a school, in a university, get people to represent these different views and make it an educational movement.
In addition to the audience here, we also have an audience on the internet, and I just want to ask one question which was sent in by internet. My name is Jesus Martinez from the Sonora, Mexico local of the MSIA. I would like Helga to explain a bit more who Hermes Trismegisto was and why is he attacked by conservatives?
Well, I mean, I try to make this point that it's, and we have here some experts in the front line who can also, Bill Salisbury, who has been working on this subject for a very long time. I mean, with all of these ancient documents, it is very, very treacherous ground. I mean, what I can say for sure is that Tod and Hermes Trismegisto are the same. That the Tod was regarded to be the god of wisdom, the one who invented writing, the one who invented mathematics. And this is a very old tradition of maybe 2,000 years before Christ or even longer, because some of the early things I try to show you go actually back, you know, to the second millennium BC. But it may be even older. So you have on the one side, you have the Egyptian mythology or theology, which obviously also was very deeply philosophical. And this lasted over long periods of times with, you know, I mean, I couldn't go into all the different phases of Egyptian history. I mean, there were also, you know, they were conquered several times. You had collapses of civilization, then you had high points again. So you have to imagine that this body of knowledge was transmitted, not so easy. You had many ups and downs, so to speak. And then, you know, after the dark and the whole point that there was a colonization from Egypt of some parts of the Mediterranean world is also very clear. I think the idea that not only Crete was colonized, but also parts of Egypt, I think is very clear. So then you had the Dark Age in Greece, and you know, probably through these natural catastrophes. And then you had the conquering of Egypt through the so-called Ptolemaic dynasties or monarchies. And in this period, you have this combination of, on the one side, Greek thinkers who studied in Egypt, but also Egyptian influences. I mean, it was, the way I understand it, it was a back and forth. And in that period, the so-called Hermetic writings became written down. This is a compendium of many different writings. They were not written at the same time. They don't discuss, they are very diverse in terms of the subjects. And the big controversy now starts was who contributed to this early body of knowledge, where all the sources from the Greek period and the ones I quoted, they all say this comes from Egypt. That's where we got our basic knowledge. And then you have this real freak out starting in the 18th century from the Romantic movement and the Romantics. They tried to focus not on Greece, but on the Roman classics, or what they called the Roman classics, and even, you know, then the Middle Ages and the Nordic mythologies, and they tried to replace the Greek influence altogether. So this was a war, you know, where the colonial powers basically were abhorred, and I think that much is totally clear. They were completely abhorred about the idea that Asian, African philosophical roots contributed to the emergence of Greek classical period. And a whole bunch of history writing was done in order to prevent that obvious continuity. Because if you look at the arguments made by some of these people, there is a lot of room for debate if you discuss it from an archaeological standpoint, from a philological standpoint, because these are very difficult things to track. But I think the reason why this is attacked so much is because, I mean, I tried to say that Nicolaus of Cusa, who in my view is together with Leibniz and Plato, I mean, these are the towering minds of European philosophy, and he attributes some of his most important conceptions to this Hermetic tradition, man in the image of God, the negative theology that you cannot comprehend God with concrete descriptions, the whole coincia oppositorum thinking, which is a specific method which you can read. I made a speech about in Bad Schwalbach in May. It's a very unbelievable way to not think in an Aristotelian way. You remember, Aristotle had this famous sentence that two things cannot be true and untrue at the same time, and that out of this contradiction he constructs in his deductive method. Nicolaus consciously attacked that and said, no, you have to think from above. You have to think the unity first, and then you go into the differentiation, which is a completely different, it's the opposite of Aristotelian thinking. And, you know, if man is a second god, you know, when he is truly creative, this is a poisonous idea from the standpoint of the oligarchs, because it sets man free on the highest level. So I think that they attack this because it is a very powerful a thing to think that mankind was one and that these ideas developed to the level where we have them today.
Dennis Speed.
I think what the presentation did was it demonstrates the significance of the role of the International Caucus of Labor Committees and the Schiller Institute globally. What Helga did is something which is virtually impossible for an American to do. Virtually impossible. And not because people don't have perhaps access to some of the details, but the inability to think from the standpoint of universal history makes this virtually impossible. It doesn't mean that people shouldn't study it. There's been a long-standing, decades-long gang-counter-gang operation around this. Tony referred to it. But it's not just black nationalism versus white racists. It's not that simple. It's run by the British. It's run out of Harvard, largely. And the people that she mentioned, don't get silly, okay? Just listen for a minute, because it's important. The people that she mentioned that were attacked by Lefkowitz, many of them have been in touch with or are known to some of our members, like John Henry Clark, for example, is now deceased, was a subscriber for many years out of Hunter College. Yosef Ben Chokanon, who you mentioned, somebody I took classes with back in 1970, 71, so on and so forth. The problem that a lot of these gentlemen had was they were deeply enraged at the following phenomenon. In American history and historiography, you have the illiterate and you have the semi-literate. Sometimes the illiterate suspect the truth. Then the semi-literate denounce them for it on behalf of the system. And what happens is that they react. They react emotionally. And this is what you've had for years, for decades now, on this question of a so-called black nationalist or Afrocentric approach or response. For example, this whole business with the Black Athena. This is something that actually some members of our organization discussed many years back, and it was already mentioned that Bill Salisbury did some very important work on this. The way that Lefkowitz attacked the people who were working in this area, not only Bernal, was that she's a classics scholar and they are not. That is, that Bernal is not a classics scholar, but she is. So she wrote this book, Not Out of Africa, made a big attack, and essentially the notion was simply ridiculed that anybody black anywhere in the world, whether that's in the Nubian civilization or the Egyptian civilization, or the idea that the Egyptian civilization could have anybody black in it. This is the way in which the game is played, so that even if you get someone who will state, that's what Lefkowitz, for example, does. She says, well, sure, there may have been something that Egypt did, but that it wasn't black. To say that that was black is simply absurd. And so you play different games with this. And I just would point out just two things which I think are important. There's a series of books that were done back in the 1980s by the Demonils. Called The Image of the Black in Western Art. Now what they did was they went around and collected all the images that they could find of blacks in what they called Western art. They found a lot of different artifacts in Egypt, and they found some very interesting things in Greece, because what you find in Greece is you find not only statues of Africans as singers, as poets, as musicians, and so forth and so on. There's also a question about who sculpted them. But remember that the Greek is not an ethnic group, not at that time. It's not seen that way. It's a language group. You could be black-skinned and be a Greek because you spoke Greek. That's what made you a Greek. Those who did not speak Greek were called barbarians. But your skin color didn't define you as being Greek. It was your language. And so what's important is to understand that when you talk about some of these things in America, you find these very peculiar problems. For example, the peculiar bunch at Harvard, Cornel West, and this character, what's the character, the idiot that went to Africa? Gates, Henry Louis Gates, who embarrassed virtually everyone in America by this funny tourist trip he took through Africa that they then turned into a PBS series, which was really an apology for the impending attack on Sudan, among other things. What Gates was actually charged with doing under the guise of doing a tour of Africa was to create the conditions under which the present regime in Sudan would be attacked later or justified as a target of opportunity. So this is out of Harvard, and that's how they run it. So you're not looking at the Black Studies program of Harvard. You're looking at William Yandel Elliott, the Southern Strategy, and what Stan wrote about. So what's interesting, what's important is that, see, what Helga has done with this, she's brought up something, particularly with respect to the Bernal books, but not just Bernal himself. It's the idea, remember, she posed this notion, why would this be seen as an attack on Western civilization? Who would cause that to be the formula that you would automatically take when all you're doing is you're identifying something which just makes not only sense, but is necessarily consistent with the entire idea of universal culture and universal history that Schiller outlined and which he went through. I just want to mention one last thing on this. In the period of the 12th century, 13th century, Frederick II Hohenstaufen, who was involved at that time in trying to stop a very fratricidal, nearly genocidal conflict between Christianity and Islam, formulated a plan, a project, in which he made the Saint Maurice of Africa this topic of a series of statues, sculptures, paintings, and so forth, and this was then extended into Europe over a period of several hundred years thereafter. And you'll find all over Europe, you'll find in Latvia, the Czech Republic, Germany in particular, you'll find in various other places in Africa, you'll find all these pictures, all these statues, literally scores of them, of this black saint, Saint Maurice, painted and clearly portrayed as black, done by many different people. Now, the function of this was, the purpose of this was to stop what I believe that Hohenstaufen recognized as an increasing tendency to racialize these conflicts. And, of course, the Venetians and their pioneering of the slave trade in particular were very, very hot on this. What we're doing with this, what Helga's done with this, is, and this doesn't come out of new work, this is stuff she's been working on for a long time in conjunction with many other people, is to raise this question of the dialogue of civilizations from the standpoint of Schiller's universal history, and to raise it in such a fashion that we get involved in a very, very good fight with the gang-counter-gang operation, which appears to be Afrocentric versus British racist, but it's a lot more involved than that. You know, the idea of white culture is not something that black radicals started. No, white culture was a term that was used during the 1830s and 1840s in the South, particularly in South Carolina, to describe what was called the neoclassical movement in architecture and in art, supposedly, that existed in America. So the notion of white culture, European culture's white culture, didn't come from black nationalists. They're not that original. They didn't come up with that. It's the typical thing you see. Most of the attacks on Western civilization that you find, particularly this kind of character involved in, the so-called cultural and nationalists of the Afrocentrists, all originated with usually white European anti-Western sources during the 1920s and so on. Take a look at, for example, Picasso's African period. Take a look at that. That thing, I think that's right before his Cubism period or his Ice Cubism period, depending on how you want to look at it. Let me just look at it. That's where this stuff comes from. So it's a Harvard-based operation. And so what she's done is to help to resurrect, or rather to rescue what is a body of very valuable intelligence that some people have turned up, but is not really accessible to the American audience generally. And I also would just like to say that I hope that we'll be able to involve, I know that Helga's worked on this also, some of the Africans from Sudan and other locations who actually have a far better grasp of all this stuff, particularly when you get to this question of so-called black culture and certainly African culture. They have a far better grasp. They have the language capabilities. They have the idea of universal culture. And it would be a very, very funny and amusing scene to see the reaction of both the Afrocentrists and various British white racist types to these Africans asserting and demonstrating the validity of the hypothesis that she's already offered here.
Denise Henderson.
Hello, I'm Denise Henderson from Leesburg. 20 years ago, when I was in a region, I gave a class on how important, not realizing, to be honest, that I was giving a class on how important this connection between, the Arab Renaissance and the United States was. What I did was I was able to do some research and discover, well, frankly, I found a letter from, I think it was either Increase Mather or Cotton Mather. I tend to think it was Increase Mather. I just don't remember at this moment. But what it was about was that in 1719, and there are probably several indications of this, but the point about this particular letter from the Levant is that it was then published in the Journal of the Royal Society and then transmitted to Increase Mathers because he subscribed to the journals. And the effect of this was very crucial for America, because or for, you know, the colonies at that time, because what it was a letter from a woman who was stationed with her husband in the Levant. And she and her family, along with, you know, many other Europeans who traveled in that area, had been inoculated with live smallpox virus to protect them from smallpox. And what happened is she wrote a letter about this to the Royal Society. Increase Mather or Cotton, whichever one it was, immediately picked this up and began an in-depth inoculation program in the Massachusetts Bay Colony, which saved many lives. That was then transmitted to the other northern colonies, including Pennsylvania. And anyone who's read Benjamin Franklin's autobiography also knows that Benjamin Franklin has the very tragic story of how he was more frightened of having his youngest son, whom he loved greatly, inoculated. And so his son, ironically, died of smallpox. But this became a project of inoculation that was transmitted through, you know, through this Arab, you know, through, I mean, we know Ibn Sina had started the medical revolution. It was still alive and being transmitted through these channels. And the Americans not merely read about it and said, oh, gee, what a nice idea. They immediately acted upon it. They realized that this was crucial. And when you think about the effects of saving small children in a colony, saving, you know, saving adults in a colony. And of course, if you've ever read John Adams, maybe John Q also talks about it, diaries, they describe, because this was still going on. And this is all going on, remember. The importance of this is it's going on before Edward Jenner did his work. And Adams has a section where he describes how they would be put in a room for 2 weeks, given the live vaccination, and watch. They were in these sort of sweat houses and stuff, and various things were done to make sure they didn't actually get the disease itself, because, again, this was live virus. So then, of course, in 1810, Jenner is trying to implement this program in Britain. And what the British ruling classes are doing is trying to ensure that only the ruling classes, basically, are getting the smallpox, the cowpox inoculation. Because if you look at these cartoons that were done at the time, you know, remember now, for 50 years, people in America have been inoculated. And what they're doing in Britain is they're saying, oh, aren't you afraid you'll turn into a cow? They really tried to scare the lower classes and prevent them from thinking that inoculation was a good thing. Well, in America, there's a completely different situation going on. So, I mean, I want to write that up, but I haven't been able to yet, but it's a crucial example of the importance of the transmission, because it's because of the transmission of science, the transmission of progress from one culture to the next.
You've been listening to EIR Talks, presenting Helga Zeplerush at the Schiller Institute President's Day Conference. To replay this program or to read the full transcript of the conference, visit our website at laruchepub.com. That's www.laruchepub.com. EIR Talks will return in a moment with closing announcements.